Coming up next on Functional Moms Podcast.
When you're sleeping, all of these reparative processes are going on. So we have a lymphatic system that we're all familiar with, but not too long ago, they discovered that we have a glymphatic system in our brain. So when we are in the deep phases of sleep, that glymphatic system is taking action. And essentially, a lot of the toxins that are in our brains from the previous day get wrung out like a sponge overnight. So we have this good brain cleansing overnight. And we also have the ability to better manage and regulate our hormones when we're having good sleep. Our hunger hormones are able to stay more balanced when we get good sleep. I mean, I think everyone who's had a bad night of sleep can attest to the fact that they are craving, you know, the sugary, quick energy foods the next day. Also, with good sleep, we are getting a lot of brain benefits and emotional regulation, I should say.
Welcome to Functional Moms Podcast, lifestyle medicine for women over 40. Let's age on our own terms.
If you're struggling with getting good quality sleep at night, this episode is for you.
Our guest today is Morgan Adams, a transformative holistic sleep coach who empowers women to conquer their battle with sleepless nights without reliance on sleep medications.
With her powerful sleep toolkit, Morgan not only ensures that women experience a profound enhancement in their sleep quality, but she also guides them in rekindling their relationship with sleep, paving the way for less stressful and more fulfilling days.
Having struggled with insomnia and dependency on prescription sleeping pills for almost a decade, Morgan understands the profound impact sleep has on one's quality of life. She's a two-time breast cancer survivor, and this experience fueled her advocacy for a lifestyle rooted in disease prevention.
Morgan, thank you so much for joining us today. We would love to start by asking, why is sleep so important? What are its benefits?
Yeah, great question to start with. Well, there's really no area of your life that sleep doesn't impact. If your sleep starts to suffer, there's this sort of domino effect on other parts of your life. But to kind of give you some of the overarching benefits of sleep, we can think about it as an opportunity to have physical repair at night. So when you're sleeping, all of these reparative processes are going on. So we have a lymphatic system that we're all familiar with, but not too long ago, they discovered that we have a glymphatic system in our brain. So when we are in the deep phases of sleep, that glymphatic system is taking action. And essentially, a lot of the toxins that are in our brains from the previous day get wrung out like a sponge overnight. So we have this good brain cleansing overnight. And we also have the ability to better manage and regulate our hormones when we're having good sleep. So our hunger hormones are able to stay more balanced when we get good sleep. I mean, I think everyone who's had a bad night of sleep can attest to the fact that they are craving, you know, the sugary, high, quick energy foods the next day. Also, with good sleep, we are getting a lot of brain benefits and emotional regulation, I should say. Mm. We're getting the ability to consolidate memories. And Matthew Walker, a really well-known sleep scientist, said that sleep is like overnight therapy. And in so many ways it is. So if you had a really stressful event during the day, what ends up happening often is during your REM stage of sleep, your brain is able to kind of take those uncomfortable memories and sort of neutralize them for the next day so that, you know, you're more calm and peaceful. And then I think one other really important benefit of sleep that gets left out of the conversation quite a bit is that it helps us really smooth our social relationships. It really helps us stay more empathetic. It helps us regulate our ability to manage conflict. They did studies showing that when people were sleep deprived, they were actually less likely to help a stranger. They were less likely to donate to a nonprofit. So it just impacts all of the areas of our life that are so important. And like I said before, you know, once sleep starts to suffer, you're going to see some kind of trickle down effect into other areas of your life that are important to you.
Why do you think middle-aged women struggle with sleep?
Yeah, great question. So midlife women do struggle more. Statistically speaking, I think 40 to 60% of midlife women are struggling with some kind of sleep issue. And there are a few main reasons why this is happening. Number one, kind of an obvious answer, is that during that midlife shift, our hormones are kind of all over the place, and then they go through a decline over time. So that really can impact quality of our sleep, as well as we have the tendency to have more anxiety and depression in midlife. And when you have those types of mental health challenges, it leaves you more vulnerable to insomnia. And then really the third overarching reason why midlife women are struggling more with their sleep is because we have a lot of competing demands on us at this stage of our lives. Mm. So for example, a 45-year-old woman could very well have children that she's still raising at home. Maybe they're teenagers. She also might have aging parents who she's responsible for taking care of in some capacity. And on top of all that, she is likely going to be at the height of her career game if she has a career. She might be a manager. She might own her own business. So you can imagine all of those competing demands could set the stage for more anxiety and stress, which definitely impacts sleep.
Right. Not to mention herself managing her own health. And
exactly.
Well, and with your hormones in play, that's even more stressful. It's a really difficult pattern there between your hormones and then the sandwich of your aging parents right. and your kids. It's just thinking about it makes me stressed.
It's like the perfect storm. And I like that you use the word the sandwich generation, Kristen, because that's quite often, you know, what it's described as, because you're kind of caught in the middle because you've got to manage yourself, but you've also got people in other generations you're trying to kind of look out for. So it's a stressful time.
Yeah. So we would like to know what the difference is between just struggling with sleep and having true insomnia.
Yeah, good question. So with insomnia, the clinical definition of that is having trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, or waking up too early, and having unrefreshing sleep at least 3 nights a week for 3 months. That is chronic insomnia. On top of that, there has to be some kind of, I guess what you would say, dissatisfaction with your sleep or some kind of daytime impairment that you're noticing. So that is really how we look at insomnia. Now, most of us will just struggle with sleep intermittently throughout our lives. A lot of people have what we call shorter term acute insomnia, and that's often triggered by an event in our life. And quite often we just sort of, that works itself out. But it's, everyone is at risk of having a bad night of sleep. And I just like to normalize this because I think quite often in our society and in the media, I see a lot of this all the time because of being a sleep coach. A lot of content is shared with me and ads and so forth. And there's this sort of like expectation that every night of sleep should be perfect. And that is just not how we're wired. We are wired to occasionally have a bad night of sleep for whatever reason. There may be a multitude of reasons. There may be a siren outside, or, you know, you may have had food too late and you wake up because you've got digestive issues, a multitude of reasons.
Well, you have a 21-year-old that still lives with you.
Oh, I bet that could be interesting.
So I just want to be clear, because when I think of insomnia, I think of you're trying to go to sleep and maybe you fall asleep, like you wake up at 2 a.m. and you can't go back to sleep. And then like at 5 a.m, you finally fall asleep, but then you have to wake up in an hour to go to work.
That's the worst.
That's a very, I mean, I've been in that situation. It's not pleasant. I had insomnia right. for 8 years, intimately relate to that. Now that could happen just on a random night to somebody, you know, once a month. And we would not consider that insomnia. That would just be a bad night of sleep. But if that scenario is happening, you know, 3 or more nights a week, then that is really, I think, cause for getting help with that issue.
Right. So then that would be classified as like you have insomnia.
Yes.
So is insomnia also like you go to sleep and you wake up periodically throughout the night? Maybe you're not up for 5 hours, but maybe you're up like periodically throughout the night, waking up randomly 3 to 5 times throughout the night or so.
Yeah, that could be insomnia as well. But if I was working with somebody, with my clients, I have them keep a like a spreadsheet kind of sleep journal. And if I'm seeing multitudes of awakenings throughout the night, my little radar goes off to talk about sleep apnea, sleep breathing issues.
Oh.
Yeah. Because when you're having trouble breathing at night, it usually happens more than once. And you can sometimes see those little, like if you have a sleep tracker, sometimes you can see these little white little marks on your tracker. And if there's a lot of those over the course of the night, it is cause for concern, I think, to have your sleep breathing looked at.
Mm.
Now, not for every single person, because I mean, like, for example, let's just say you had indigestion and you just kept waking up a lot because of indigestion, or you had a cold because your nose was stuffy or whatever. Like, there's physical reasons that make sense that are more transient. But if you're noticing a pattern for quite a stretch of time of these multiple awakenings, that's definitely cause for further investigation for sure.
That's okay. A good point. Now, so for people that wake up in the middle of the night, that's a common thing. You hear people wake up around 3 a.m. What would be causing that?
Yeah, so multiple number of reasons, but I do like to talk about the 3 a.m. wake-ups in context of the fact that waking up during the night is normal. Like, we weren't really designed to sleep solidly 8 hours. Normal awakenings happen for often reasons because we have finished a sleep cycle. So when you complete a full sleep cycle, you have a brief awakening. And it's really sort of what they say is that it's designed for sort of an evolutionary safety feature. You wake up briefly, scan your surroundings for safety, and then you go right back to sleep. If you wake up for less than 2 or 3 minutes, you're actually not going to recall that awakening. But the problem is when we have the awakenings and we recall them, and we are kind of stuck in the moment thinking, oh my gosh, what's wrong with me? Why am I not getting right to sleep? So the reasons besides just the completing the sleep cycle would be multitude. It could be because of the sleep breathing issues. That could be an issue. And often we have people who are waking up because they're too hot. And it doesn't necessarily mean they're having a hot flash, but they're just, you know, their temperature is too high. And then we have situations where there is a blood sugar dip at 2 or 3 a.m. and that's causing this cortisol and adrenaline spike, which wakes us up. So in that situation, you know, one thing people can do is test that out and see if having a very small snack, like an hour before bed, helps regulate that blood sugar balance. And maybe they won't wake up. So those are a few of the common reasons why people wake up. And then what do you do about it when you wake up? So there are a few different strategies. You'll often hear people say, get out of bed if you're not asleep in 20 minutes, go to another room and do something cool, comfortable and relaxing. And I do agree with that to some extent, but I don't necessarily think, A, there needs to be like a time frame put on it, like 20 minutes. What is the, and besides, I don't want anyone who I'm working with to have a clock by their bed where they're like looking at the clock and exacerbating their anxiety. Mm-hmm. So if you're the kind of person who can kind of just lie there and maybe do some deep breathing or some, maybe just some, a body scan in bed and you're relaxed, there's no need to get out of bed, in my opinion. The reason why you'd want to get out of bed is if you are in a situation where you are tossing and turning, you've got a lot of anxious ruminating thoughts, you're being stressed, you feel stressed out, because ultimately we don't want you to be linking your bed with anxiety. We want to unpair those two situations. So if, for example, you're lying in bed and it's 3 a.m. and you're having, you know, some catastrophic thoughts, and by the way, catastrophic thoughts are more apt to happen at that time of night.
Definitely. I can attest to that. Yeah.
Because we're operating, and we're operating from our amygdala. Our prefrontal cortex has kind of gone offline for the night. So you definitely may notice, I sure have noticed, that the thoughts that I have at 2 or 3 a.m. are not the same thoughts I have at 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. So first of all, if you're having those thoughts, just remind yourself, like, I'm not thinking rationally, and there's literally nothing I can do about this situation at the moment. So if you are lying there in bed stressed out, really, really do take the opportunity to get out of bed and do something more relaxing until you become sleepy again and get up and then go back to bed. That would be my recommendation.
Hey, what are things that would not be helpful? Because I know I've been guilty of grabbing my phone or something in the middle of the night, which is probably the worst thing you could do. So I'm just curious.
Yeah, that is actually not the most helpful thing for a couple reasons.
The light.
Number one, the blue light is stimulating you. It is suppressing your melatonin. And then what we tend to do is we tend to doom scroll. We get on social media and we start to scroll, and it can be cognitively alerting. It can be also just too cognitively stimulating for us. So I definitely, you know, I urge all of my clients to, before they go to bed, put their phone to bed in another room, to not even have it beside you. It's too tempting. Also, there's the issue of the EMFs, the electromagnetic fields. You don't want those next to your head while you're sleeping, because the EMFs actually can impair our bodily healing processes. So the time to heal is overnight. You don't want to like have anything get in the way of that. So just having your phone out of sight is really the best thing to do. And if you need an alarm to wake up, you could either have your phone in the next room turned up loud or whatever, or you could just have like an old-fashioned alarm clock of some sort next to your bed. Mm-hmm. And maybe get one that's not very jarring because those are annoying, but they've got the light stimulating alarm clocks like Hatch that kind of give you this gentle sunrise effect and kind of a gentle wake-up noise, like maybe birds chirping or something like that.
Something that helps me is white noise.
Yes.
Like having some type of white noise. For some reason, that seems to soften the edges for me when I'm trying to sleep. And then another thing, and I don't know if this is good or not, and I would love to ask you, is something else that I'll do is sometimes I'll listen to like, I personally listen to like Joyce Myers or something, and she's just talking about, you know, whatever it is, the topic that she's talking about. And it's just like her talking in the background, and I just go to sleep listening to her. And that helped me a lot in, especially when I first became a single mom, because I felt like I was listening to my own thoughts too much and it was driving me insane. So I would just listen to her and there were much better words. Like it just made me feel better. And so that was good. However, the bad news is that was from my phone. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of, you know, listening to positive affirmations or music that helps soothe you before sleep. But what I do personally, because I do like what I call it sleep music, but it's basically like music tracks from like the Inside Timer meditation app. And what I do, because I don't want that phone in my bedroom, is I have a little Bluetooth speaker and I put it on the opposite side of my room. Like you kind of want to have like an 8-foot bubble between you and any electronics. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, my husband is in that bubble, but I'm outside of the bubble. Poor guy. It has to go somewhere, right? So I have it turned on and I have the music sort of stuff playing, and it cuts off after the track is over. So the track is set to be about 60 minutes and it cuts off. There's no more sound. I do have a white noise machine in the background though, because I am a light sleeper. And, occasionally a pet will make a sound or there's a air conditioning or heating system kind of little clank going on. And that white noise kind of disguises those sounds.
Yeah, that helps me
too. I love that. And I have to say, one of your tips was to keep it cool. That was my missing link. Like in my early 40s, I think I started to just run hotter. I wasn't having hot flashes, but I just ran hotter at night and my room ran hot. And so I got something called a chili pad. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it cools your bed.
Have I ever? Yes. I had a chili pad for a couple years. I loved it. It broke a little over a year ago. And during the time that it broke, the company was in between owners and essentially they had shut down. Like you couldn't order the chili pads. You couldn't have yours fixed. And I was so like desperate, for the cooling that I went over to the competitor 8Sleep and got a similar mattress pad. It has a little bit more bells and whistles and technology. It tracks your sleep as well. But I can personally attest to the fact that these things really do help your sleep, especially if you're a hot sleeper. They are game changers.
Yeah. I didn't realize I was running such a hot temperature at night. But what a difference. I stopped that 3 a.m. wake up. Like I was always waking up at 3 a.m. And so I just have to put that out there for people.
I'm so glad you figured that out.
Yeah. And for anyone that, their room might just be too hot.
Yeah. Exactly.
What are your thoughts on the grounding sheets that also say that apparently is supposed to help with sleeping?
Well, I've changed my tune on those lately after seeing some content from some other health practitioners. Essentially, they could be making the problem worse because if your outlet is not actually grounded, you could just be recirculating dirty electricity into your sleep space. So you have to plug the grounding sheet into an outlet, right?
Right.
So if the outlet that you're plugging it into is not grounded, you could essentially be recirculating, I guess, quote, dirty electricity into your sleeping space.
Yeah.
So unless you really know what you're doing and maybe you have an electrician come out and kind of test everything. I would personally shy away from those. And it's funny because I've been getting asked that question a ton lately. Maybe there's just some content online out there about the grounding sheets. I do have one lady that I know, another podcaster, who told me that they help her immensely with pain. She has some body pain and they help with her body pain. So, I mean, if you're using them already and you're noticing benefits, I wouldn't throw them away. I would just be a careful consumer before you invest in something like that.
Yeah, I never would have thought of that.
Yeah, I did. Now that you mentioned that, I do remember reading something about that, about like when you plug it in and it could be recycling. And so you're actually defeating the purpose of why you're actually using it. And that there's like some type of copper thing that you can install, or, you know.
Yeah, like it's like, I think a copper rod that maybe goes outside. And it's just, it sounds like kind of a mess to me. Like, I just don't want to add that much complexity to my life.
It does get complicated. Yeah.
Yes. Just go outside and camp outside in your backyard. Sleep on the grass.
Yeah. And I mean, I would just like, I'm a big proponent of grounding your feet on the earth. I think that's really helpful. But obviously, you know, that's not always practical, you know, throughout the night. Unless you want to sleep on the ground and go camping, knock yourself out.
Yeah, but,
what are your thoughts on using sleeping pills?
I'm not a fan. Actually, I was dependent on sleeping pills for about 8 years. And my thoughts on them are this. I think there is a time and a place for them. I don't want to completely demonize them. They were meant for short-term use only. If you look at the package insert on them, it does say clearly they're not to be used over 4 weeks. However, you know, my situation, I was on them for 8 years. I've worked with clients who've been on them for 10, 15, almost 20 years.
Wow.
They're really meant to be used in a crisis situation, like divorce, death, job loss, or some kind of crisis. So the reason why I think that I'm not a fan of them long term is that they really do mask the issue. They don't get to the root cause. They are just, it's a temporary fix, a temporary Band-Aid. And since you all like the functional root cause approach, you know, if you're of that mindset, a lot of clients come to me because they do not really believe the sleeping pills are going to be the long-term solution. So they want more holistic strategies, which is what I work on them with. Sleeping pills tend to functionally give you a little bit more sleep. Like they give you like maybe 20 to 40 minutes, but you have to kind of look at the cost-benefit analysis of that. So the downside is that quite often you have impaired functioning during the daytime. So do you really want to get 20 more minutes of sleep at the expense of brain fog, grogginess in the morning? And that was, I definitely suffered from that. And I believe 80% of people who take sleeping pills have some kind of residual side effect the next day from it.
Right.
And when you say sleeping pills, are you talking more about prescription or are you talking about what you could buy at CVS?
I'm talking about prescription. I'm talking about Ambien, Lunesta, Sonata, benzodiazepines. Now, I have come across people who have said to me, oh, I don't take prescription stuff. I take Benadryl every night. And they think they have like a pass for that because it's available for anyone to buy at the drugstore. But they contain diphenhydramine, which is an ingredient that is starting to become linked with cognitive function, long-term use in older adults. And it's not saying that, you know, you're going to have dementia or cognitive decline if you use these, but they are showing, you know, some correlation with the long-term, more frequent use. So I would say pay attention to that, and not to say never take them, but, you know, take them on just occasion versus like relying on it every night.
Yeah. And I was surprised to see that Unisom is really the same thing as Benadryl, or it has the same active. Is that the ingredient that you just mentioned?
Yeah. Diphenhydramine. Yeah. Antihistamine.
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts on the melatonin gummy bears that you see when you're walking down the aisle, like sleep well in a healthy way? Is that true or?
Well, I'm a little bit dubious of the melatonin gummies because quite often the melatonin products that are available in a drugstore or a grocery store haven't actually been tested for purity.
Right.
We know that with synthetic melatonin, there's 13 potential contaminants in them. And several years ago, they did a study in Canada where they pulled melatonin bottles from shelves in pharmacies and grocery stores. And they found a very wide variance between what was advertised on the bottle and what was in them. So you could get like much less melatonin than you thought you were getting, or you could get a lot more. And when you have excess amount of melatonin, sometimes people get grogginess, they get nightmares. So I am not opposed to melatonin. I actually think there may be a good use case scenario for people over 50 to supplement with a very, very small dose of melatonin, because we know that once we get into our 50s, there's no magic number, but our melatonin production does start to decline a bit. So there, to me, there's an argument for to be made for supplementing with a small amount. But you, again, you just want to be a smart consumer and buy melatonin brands that are, you know, pharmaceutical grade. I'm a big proponent of a particular brand called Herbitonin. It's a plant melatonin made with alfalfa, chlorella, and rice. And they show that there was like 5 to 7 times more antioxidant and anti-inflammatory capabilities than synthetic melatonin. So that's the one that I use when I lean in on melatonin.
And can you just buy that like at a health food store, or how would you get that?
Well, you can buy it from their website. I have something on my website that offers like a discount code.
Great.
I mean, we could put that in the link if you in the show notes.
Yeah, sure. Definitely. Absolutely.
I love that.
It gives
That's
people
great.
A little bit of a price break. It's not like available at a CVS or anything like that, though, widespread.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful. That was really super helpful. Thank you.
Is there a connection between sleep deprivation and weight loss resistance?
Absolutely. Yeah,
we thought so.
Know, yeah, we definitely know that people who are getting, you know, 5 or 6 hours of sleep are going to have a higher propensity to be obese. And one of the reasons why this happens is because when we are sleep deprived, we have an imbalance in our hunger hormones. So we have this hunger hormone called ghrelin. And I remember this as ghrelin is like the hunger monster, the gremlin, if you will.
Right.
And the ghrelin actually makes you hungrier. So you're just going to be hungrier and hungrier when this hormone is jacked up. And then you have something called leptin, which is your satiety hormone. So you don't make as much of this leptin. So you're not able to get satiated. So the foods that you're going to choose when you are sleep deprived inevitably are going to be kind of the high carb, high sweets foods. Like when you've had a really bad night of sleep, you're not craving a salad. You're craving, you know, French fries or, you know, chips or something like that. So yeah, if you are wanting to go on a weight loss journey, one of the first things you're going to want to do is get your sleep dialed in and make sure you're getting enough sleep, because it's you're fighting a losing battle, essentially, if you're not getting enough sleep and you're trying to lose weight in the process.
Wow, that's really great. I want to make sure that we get to ask this question before you leave us. What's more important with sleep, quality or quantity?
Yeah, that's a very good question, asked a lot. And so my answer would be quality. Quantity matters, but what I would really say is the most important is consistency. So they did a huge study January of this year where they looked at thousands and thousands of people. And what they were able to uncover was that consistency in sleep was actually linked to lower mortality rates. So in this particular study, they showed that people who slept on a consistent basis, 6 hours a night, had a lower mortality rate than people who slept 8 hours within a regular sleep schedule. So really, there's not just one metric that we're looking for. We're really looking for consistency. We're looking for quality. And quantity does matter. We're looking for 7 to 9 hours. So there's a few different factors that play into what healthy sleep is. But it's, I think sometimes as of late, over the past few years, I feel like the message has been just like, get 8 hours of sleep. And like, there's so much more to that statement than just that.
I'm trying to understand, just to be clear, like when you said the consistency matters and you said somebody can be getting 6 hours of sleep and somebody can be getting 8 hours of sleep, what was the difference?
Yeah.
I missed that part.
Yeah. I don't think I fully explained that. So 6 hours on a consistent schedule. So their sleep and wake times were pretty much consistent from night to night. So maybe they were going to bed 10, getting up at 6, and they were pretty consistent about that routine versus maybe someone with 8 hours, they're going to bed at midnight one night, 10 o'clock one night. They're getting up at 5 one night, 7.
Okay.
So they're kind of all over the place, you know?
Yes, I understand now.
And in fact, I did hear just a few minutes ago a podcast where they were interviewing one of the head scientists for the Whoop band. And she was talking about aggregate client data, like thousands and thousands of people they looked at over the pandemic. They were looking at like younger people, like 18 to 23. But still, I think it's interesting because this data could be probably extrapolated into older ages. The people who were sleeping with the tightest window of consistency, they were actually reporting less illness and injury.
Interesting.
So it's keeping us healthy. It's keeping us healthier on all levels. Mental health issues start to decline when we get really irregular with our circadian rhythm. So keeping that tight within a half, you've got a little half hour of wiggle room in there. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, you're kind of getting a little bit into the danger zone with too much latitude.
Well, being mindful of our time today, Morgan, what are two simple things we can do today to improve our sleep?
So I would start, this is sort of a kind of a follow-up with what I just said, is really dialing in with your consistency. And I think that the best way to get that is controlling your wake-up time and having a very, very regular wake-up time, because we can actually control what time we wake up. You know, that's something, I mean, we may not like it, but we have control over that. And so what you'll find is when you have a very consistent wake-up time, you will become sleepy around the same time each night because your body is going to kind of collect this sleepy chemical called adenosine over the course of the day. After about 16 or 17 hours, that adenosine needs to be released in the form of sleep. So just by default of going to getting up at the same time every morning, you're going to start to become more regular about when you're probably going to go to sleep, as long as you pay attention to your sleepy cues and not Netflix.
Right. Would taking a nap during the day throw that off?
It could. That's a great question. So naps are something that I think are a great practice for just getting a little cognitive boost, a little physical boost. But you want to make sure that the naps are in the earlier part of the day. So I recommend for my clients not to nap after 3 p.m.
Okay.
And to keep the naps relatively short so that you prevent sleep inertia when you wake up. And then
what does that mean, short? What would short mean?
Short
15
would be like
minutes?
20 minutes, maybe 30.
Okay, 20 minutes max.
You kind of want to avoid getting into the deeper stages of sleep unless you are kind of prepared to have some sleep inertia afterward and have the time to kind of sort that out. And then the second tip I would leave you with would be getting natural daylight exposure very, very soon upon waking. So we're looking at probably half hour after you wake up, go outside, expose yourself to the natural light for at least 10 minutes. You want to have naked eyes. You don't want to be wearing your sunglasses. The reason is because when the natural light hits your eyes, it sends the signal to your suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is your circadian pacemaker. And from there, there's this beautiful cascade of neurotransmitters and hormones that are firing off, boosting serotonin, boosting cortisol, preparing melatonin for the next night. So even if it's cloudy, you're still going to get the benefits of the natural light, and walking is a great way to get it.
What if you wear contact lenses or glasses? What do you do?
So there's been a little bit of a controversy about that because a couple years ago, Andrew Huberman started sharing this information and he had said it's fine to wear contacts. But now what we're seeing from a lot of the circadian health folks is that contacts actually can impair that process. Mm-hmm. And I do know that there are, I don't know the top off my head, I'd have to research it, but there are contact brands out there that allow that light in.
Oh, okay.
So that's something to look into.
I'm going to have to look into that. Yes.
But what I mostly see, honestly, in my neighborhood are, I walk my dog every morning. I mean, I'm practicing what I preach. I'm doing the stuff I'm telling you about. I'm not just talking about it, but I see a lot of people walking their dogs and they're like, they seem very happy to be outside, but they've got these sunglasses on that are just completely blocking all of those beautiful things from happening.
Right.
Just remember to your sunglasses. Now, you'd be safe. You know, if you're driving somewhere and there's glare, you want to, you know, have some sunglasses to shield the glare. But otherwise, try to wean yourself off.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Great info.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. You can connect with Morgan on Instagram. Her handle is @morganadams.wellness or visit her website, morganadamswellness.com. Yeah. And we'll definitely put that other information of that brand that you were talking about that the listeners will be able to get a discount on in our, we'll put a link.
Yeah. Check the show notes.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Morgan.
Thank you, ladies.
The information provided in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purpose of diagnosing, curing, treating, or preventing any disease. We are functional medicine certified health coaches and not licensed medical professionals. The opinions and advice of guests are their own and also not considered to be medical advice. Always consult with a healthcare professional when making any healthy lifestyle changes. We would love to hear from you. Please leave a comment or review. Email us at info@functionalmoms.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit the subscribe button.